It's now being recorded.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the locking of a domain name subject to your UDIP proceedings. Call on the 8th of November. On the call today, we have Gabriella Slack, Randy Ferguson, Alan Greenberg, Hago Dafala, Christine Durain, Volker Greenman, Gabriella Slack, Juan Manuel Rojas, and Celia Lerman. We have apologies from Faisal Sa, David Mayer. From the staff, we have Marika Connings, Barry Cobb, Glenn de Saint-Géry, and myself, Julia Charbolin. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you. And for the record, we have apologies from Michaela Nalon.
Okay.
All right. What is the first item on the agenda? Does anyone have any changes to the agenda before we go ahead? It's posted on the Adobe screen at the upper right. Hearing nothing, seeing nothing. Recap from Toronto, activities in Toronto. Marika, do we have anything other than the full transcript? Has anyone, I know I mentioned it to Barry last week, but I don't know if anything was done on it. Has anyone attempted to sort of extract the salient points from it, things that were mentioned there that may not have already been brought up in our discussions and we need to capture? Certainly my impression was there was some substantive discussion there and perhaps some new issues.
This is Marika.
Please go ahead.
This is Marika. I took quite detailed notes, and what I'm actually in the process of doing is developing the initial report. And basically my idea would be to incorporate those, you know, the comments in the relevant sections relating to the charter questions and integrate them in that way together with, you know, the other discussion items that we have had over the last couple of weeks and also as a result of the responses to the different public comments. So I'm happy as well to note them down separately, but I think in principle you'll see them back once I'm able to share a first draft.
Okay, as long as we're making sure to capture them and address them, you know, at the same level as we are for the public comments, because that was one of, I thought was one of the more productive panels of its type that I've been to, and I suspect there is stuff that came out there that perspectives that haven't been aired until now, or at least not well. So I'm not sure we need any further review at this point, if anyone has any comments, other than to note that it was a very productive session, I thought, and with a small number of people, but good participation. And hopefully it will add a couple of our things to our discussion points. Any other comments on Toronto? Seeing none, hearing none. The next item on our agenda is review of the work group plan, and clearly, if you look at it, we are way behind, or it was set unrealistically, and we need some adjustments on this. I have a specific question. Obviously, we need to, you know, we're going to have to take another meeting or two meetings or something like that to finish the review of the public comment review tool, or finish the filling out the review tool. And that pushes everything else back a week or two. Marika, I have a question, though, on the initial report. It's my impression that we really have not had substantive discussion trying to come to closure on the various issues. And is your feeling that we should start drafting the report and when faced with that we don't know what to put, do the discussions in that format or try to come to some overall conclusions ahead of time?
This is Marika. So I have already started working on the initial report, and you know, I've already completed like the more standard parts, like, you know, the background and you know, the process. And now I've started working on the more, you know, substantive issues on the charter question. So what I've started doing is basically for each of them trying to identify, you know, what is the current situation, and then basically highlight, you know, the working group discussions on those items. I think a lot of that will come from the public comment review, because I think as they are grouped along the charter questions, I think there will be possible to get a good sense of, you know, the working group's view. But what I've started doing in parallel to that, and I'm hoping it's something that, you know, the working group might find useful, is actually developing a straw man proposal. Because I think, as we've seen from the face-to-face meeting in Toronto, I think it looks like we just have, you know, there are a couple of options we can consider. And it's, I think it's just a question of trying to map out what those options are and where there is support for, you know, one or other option to see if you know, we can come to agreement to some kind of overall process flow, which then would also help answer the different charter questions. So basically, the strongman proposal I'm developing is basically based on the comments or the discussions we've had to date, and as well, you know, some of the discussions resulting from Toronto, where I think we had some of those, you know, different steps that would be in a potential process for, you know, handling the locking of a domain name in a UDRP proceeding. So if people think that's helpful, I'm, you know, working on a draft. I'm trying as well to get some internal input to make sure that, you know, it's not something crazy I'm coming up with. And then, you know, to put that out together with the initial report for, you know, of course, the working group is free to completely ignore it or tear it apart or, you know, start from scratch. But I'm hoping that might give a kind of tool or, you know, kind of starting point from where we really can get to the substance of the discussion and come to, you know, recommendations that we then can include in the initial report.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I think the straw man proposal is really the crux of it. And from my point of view, I don't know to what extent the work you're doing yields the draft final report and the straw man proposal at the same time. But certainly if you need to prioritize one over the other, the straw man, I think, is what we need on a quicker timeline than the draft report, if indeed they can be separated in terms of how you're developing them.
Yeah, and I think they can easily be separated, because what I've done now, the straw man is just a separate document. So it started in a Word document, basically doing a kind of, you know, a process flow, basically trying to align the different steps and then trying to determine, you know, what are the options that we have there, and making some suggestions based, I think, on you know, what we've discussed to date and where, you know, in certain areas I think I've seen some kind of, maybe I wouldn't call it maybe consensus, but where people seem to be leaning in a certain direction. And again, I think this is, you know, the straw man proposal is just a starting point. So to, you know, help to guide those discussions, because I think, you know, based on the discussions we've had, we're looking at several different steps in the process where I think the working group is likely to make certain recommendations.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think the straw man proposal probably will go first, and in the meantime, I can just continue working on the initial report as well, because some of the discussions probably will flow into the report eventually, because I think if we can come to agreement on a kind of straw man or flow chart elements, I think that would be an illustration together with, you know, our individual response to the charter questions.
Right. Yeah, that sounds good. What kind of time frame are you imagining on this straw man?
I'm actually hoping to get something to you in time for next week's meeting, if possible. No. As I said, I'm trying to get some internal feedback, you know, to make sure that, because, you know, as you know, different departments within ICANN are also affected by what happened here, and you know, they might have some views as well on you know, the different steps I've proposed, and some of them are more knowledgeable about the UDRP itself than I am. And as I said, what I've done now, there's also a couple of questions in there which we might not even be able to answer internally, so they might have to be turned back to the working group as well. So I'm hoping to, you know, to have something for you by next week's meeting.
Well, jumping up to item number 5 now, Michele has said he can't be at next week's meeting. I can't be at next week's meeting. So maybe we should agree to cancel that meeting, and that both gives you a bit more breathing time. The only alternative is if someone else wants to volunteer to chair it, and we believe there'll be enough people to carry on with the meeting.
Yeah, the only challenge there is that the week after, I think, is Thanksgiving in the U.S., and I don't know how many participants are affected by that.
I'm not sure. We don't have a lot of American-sounding names on our list, but I don't know how many are residing in the U.S. Well,
I think me, and this is Christine Doreen, I think, and that's, I might be the only one, so, I mean, don't hold things out. Don't change the schedule on account of me. It might be more important to get a bigger majority around.
Or you can join us and bring the turkey.
That's a possibility. It's actually the meeting is at 9 a.m. here, and we don't celebrate till much later in the day. So I actually could possibly call in from home. So
okay.
Yeah, don't reschedule. And if I'm the only U.S. participant, well, I guess a lot of ICANN staff are U.S. participants too. So maybe that's an issue too.
Barry's the only one, I think.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, so maybe that would be a better choice then. I don't know.
Yeah, well, in any case, we'll worry about that meeting next. In terms of next week, unless we have a strong desire to go ahead and a volunteer to be chair, I think we are going to have to cancel that one. I have a full day of conference calls starting at 6 a.m., and adding this one in the middle is going to be just a bit much for me. And I don't know where McKaylee is, but he said he can't do it. All right, Marika, let's tentatively put that out, and then we'll decide on the Thanksgiving meeting afterwards. It doesn't sound like there may be a huge overlap with U.S.-based people.
Okay.
Okay, and now on to the substantive part. So in terms of we never actually came to closure on what you just took off the screen on the work plan. I think we need to adjust it clearly. I'm not particularly concerned with with doing that this very moment and forecasting when the new end is. I think we're pushing everything back by, it sounds like, close to a month, given that we're already several meetings behind and we're now talking about canceling one or possibly two meetings. So if you feel so inclined and you want something more up to date, we can certainly just push things out a bit and see what it looks like. I think we are going to have to allow a bit more time for the looking at your draft straw man and fleshing that out and coming to closure on that. So we may want to allow that some explicit time in the work plan. But I'm certainly willing to just leave it be for the moment and just carry on with the work. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. A suggestion might be, because I think we, if you look at the public comment review tool, there's still quite a number of comments we need to cover before we can even move to the next level. A suggestion there might be, and I think it's something that has been done in other working groups as well, is possibly assign some of the comments to different people in the working groups to develop a response, have them circulate that to the working group to see if that would reflect other people's views. Because I think on some of these issues we've had several discussions already on the working groups. So I think in some of them we might be able to predict what the working group perspective may be, and that might be a way of moving a bit quicker through the comments and then only discussing those where people don't agree with the position that or the working group response that is noted in the review tool or those items where people think that this is really something that we really need to discuss in further detail, because either it's a very concrete proposal on how to respond to some of the charter questions or something that hasn't come up at all in any of our discussions before.
I'm certainly happy to do that if we have volunteers to carry out the work. We had a hand up from, I think, Gabriella, but she's not there anymore. So I guess her hand isn't up. Well, Marika, let's go through what we have today, and before the end of the meeting, look at where we are and if we want to try to do some assignments either here or via the list.
Okay.
At this point, we have about a half an hour. Let's see how far we can get. I've got a larger copy of the worksheet. Where are we at this point?
This is Rick. I think we are at comment 70 at page 21. Of course, there's still some comments in the beginning that we haven't covered because we started further down, but that's where we left off last time.
Scroll down. Okay. All right. Do you want to do the readouts?
Sure. This is Marika. So we're still on comments in relation to Charter Question 5, which relate to whether there should be additional safeguards created for the protection of registrants. So comment 70 in response to the registrar survey says, what other protections would registrants need? The domain name is locked, preventing any unwanted, unauthorized changes to the domain name without explicit instructions from a court. If the domain is using the registrant's DNS, they are still free to manage their website and associated services as it pertains to the domain.
So they're really asking us what other protections are.
This is Christine. I just want to say that I think, I can understand where this comment is coming from completely because, the UDRP does, the lock that's there typically does provide, some decent protections for the registrant. But I think one of the reasons, and I wasn't in the, original group that drafted the question, is I think this question sort of stems from this idea that not all registrars are consistent. So while the person who wrote this question has had what appears to be very good experiences with the registrar, knowing what to do, what type of lock is supposed to be applied, what the registrant is still allowed to continue to do with that domain name, it may be that there are other registrars out there who aren't, as cognizant of those needs and who may be, completely, like we talked about, some of them actually shut down the domain name and move it into a separate account. We may decide that that's not what we want people to do, that we do want the, domain name to resolve and we do want the registrant to still have control of their website, throughout the process. So I think that the maybe the question is more just taking in mind that, yes, some registrars are doing it right, but some registrars might not be. That's sort of my thought about this question.
Okay, thank you. Any other thoughts? I have an issue regarding the first sentence. And I don't recall, Marika, was the first sentence, what other protections would registrants need, was that actually out of the questionnaire, or is that something the registrar, I'm not sure what question they're answering. Okay.
Yeah, this is Marika. It's the Charter Question 5, which is whether additional safeguards should be created for protection of registrants in cases where the domain name is locked subject to a UDRP proceeding. The Charter Question, though.
Oh, okay. So that is, okay, sorry. All right, so the suggested answer is the procedures cover it for registrants, but with not necessarily with any consistency. So some registrars may, in fact, take procedures which disadvantage the registrant.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, we just want to make sure that the ultimate product that we create doesn't assume that every registrar is protecting registrants properly.
Got it. Marika, you're happy with that? You?
Yep.
Have words? Okay. 71, yes, the domain should be able to resolve during the period. That means if the registrant is changing hosting provider, that a domain name server should be allowed to be change. Again, that just re-echoes the conclusion we came out of the previous one, that depending on how the registrar handles it, the registrant may or may not be able to do that kind of change.
Alan, this is Christine. I put my hand
go
up,
ahead.
But I'm just interrupting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
That's okay. I don't see a long line of people jumping in to speak. So I was going to just mention that So typically, while when a domain name is locked, the registrant can manage the name. So they can do things to the website and that sort of thing. However, this one little point here is kind of a sticking point, and it's probably something that we want to offer advice on. And that is, can you actually change a hosting provider and update the DNS for that domain name, right? The servers and everything, because wouldn't that will then constitute a whois update because you're going to change the resolving server. So this
update.
One question is a little more nuanced than the one before it, I think.
of course, you know, it's one of these things that it's in the semantics. You can't point to a new DNS server. There's nothing prohibiting you from changing the contents of that DNS server if you have access to it.
Right.
So, you know, if you happen to manage your own DNS server, you can make whatever changes you want to what the website looks like, where it resides, or whatever. If you happen to be using somebody else's DNS that you don't have direct access to, then you can't.
Yeah,
such as the registrars.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the point, because this question specifically says, what if the registrar changes hosting providers?
Right.
So I think that maybe we want to make it, when we come up with our recommendation, we may want to say, you know, because we talked about, you know, sort of what are the allowed changes, right? I submitted that initial draft, and we sort of talked about it, and then we didn't really discuss it more, which I know we'll get back to. You know, what are allowed changes? And I think this raises kind of a good question.
No, and indeed, it doesn't sound fair if what we're saying is, if you're a professional, you know, website runner and you have your own DNS, you can change whatever you want.
Right.
But if you happen to be more of an amateur or relying on someone else on the registrar's services, then your hands are tied and you can't make any changes. That doesn't sound a particularly equitable set of rules. So I think we either need rules saying, even if you can change the DNS, you're not allowed to. We can't enforce it necessarily, but we can make the rule, or take off the restriction.
Correct. Yeah, I think it needs. Yeah, I think our recommendation needs to be broad enough that it covers both situations. I agree.
Right. Okay. Any other comments on this one? Okay.
Yeah. Here, this is Celia.
Yes,
so,
Celia, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Celia. So, if we allow people to change their DNS, how would it affect the UDRP process? Let's say we do accept people to change their hosting service. Would that affect in any part the defense of the two parts involved in the UDRP?
I think we need to hear from UDRP providers.
Yeah, this is Christine. I can't offhand think of any way that would really be affected. You know, so at the moment of commencement, we serve everyone who's listed in the WHOIS. As long as the WHOIS contact information doesn't change, and all you do is change, you know, which server your site points to, it's really irrelevant. I mean, remember, the UDRP doesn't permit doesn't even disallow content changes. So you could be, you know, the registrant could be posting, you know, hosting a site for counterfeit Louis Vuitton bags, but once the UDRP is filed, switch to some pay-per-click, you know, page or something, you know. I mean, that happens all the time. And that, you know, that doesn't matter. The complainants are responsible at the beginning to provide the content of the website. So if the registrant is going to update the website content or even the hosting provider, just sitting here right now thinking about it, I can't think how that would matter.
Okay, so you're saying you capture any relevant content has to be captured ahead of time. You can't presume it's going to be there throughout the process.
Correct, and complainants who do presume that take a huge gamble that something's going to change. Yeah.
As I pointed out, if the person doing it is a professional, they will be able to change the content no matter what the registrar does to lock a domain.
That's correct, yeah.
All right. I think we have something coming out of this, but I'm not quite sure what it is. But there certainly sounds like little reason to prevent some registrants from doing things when others can do it, and we can't stop them. So that does lead us to what we want to say in the outcome. And the concept of locking is getting more complex, not easier, as we go along. Okay, 72.
Oh, yeah, there's there's one comment in the chat we might want to address.
I'm not watching the chat. Thank you. I'm not sure changes to the DNS are transfers that need to be under. No, I don't know if it's Matt or Lisa making that comment. but I think that's the conclusion we're coming to. So the simplistic concept that you cannot change anything in who is, I think, is quickly disappearing. Any other comments before we go on to 72? Not seeing any, unless the typing is relevant. I think it was good enough English. All right, Marika, 72.
Yes, this is Marika, 72. Again, a comment from the registrar survey. I do think that there should be a stronger penalty for the complainant should they be found guilty of attempted reverse domain name hijacking. There's an interesting scenario, though, where the registrar may have to process urgent changes on a logged domain name, i.e. name servers, in order to keep a website operational, etc.
Can someone tell me what reverse name domain name hijacking is? Because in my current mental state, it does that. That's not something that I understand.
Yeah, Alan, this is Christine. Reverse domain name hijacking is a finding that the panel can make in the UDRP that says the complainant brought the complaint in bad faith simply to harass the respondent. So complainant knew that they were unlikely to prevail, or they're just trying to go after maybe a generic name, or some complainants use the UDRP as a way to sort of they want to start a company and somebody has the domain name they want, so they can approach them and ask to buy it, and then, of course, the registrant says, well, no, this is in my portfolio, I'm a domainer, I'll sell it to you for $5,000, you know, because that's what I do. And the complainant says, no, that's horrible, I'm going to file a UDRP and try to just yank it from you. And the panel says, well, no, you don't get to do that unless, the respondent was actually targeting your mark. And because you didn't have a mark until yesterday, that can't be possible. So usually those are the typical domain name hijacking cases. This first sentence in this comment is completely irrelevant to anything we're doing. It's just somebody being crabby about something. So really the second sentence, I think, is the exact same thing we talked about in 71, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? Jonathan.
Yeah, this is Jonathan. Yeah, I would just echo what Christine was saying, that I think that we touched on the issue in 71. It's almost like they're talking about two separate things in a statement. The first end of it being just the concern about a complainant using the process unfairly or improperly, and then the second piece about the lock having the impact on the name servers or something while it's locked. So just throw my two cents out there just to echo what she said.
Okay, thank you. I think we need to capture one of the implications of the concept of capricious UDRPs is a potential, I think it was something brought up in Toronto, and I assume we're going to capture it out of that discussion, but we want to make sure that it's somewhere of capricious UDRPs that are filed simply to get the privacy proxy information revealed. Because under current practices, a capricious UDRP may be the cheapest way to find out who's running a website. Number 73, I'll read that one out. No. I think we already have counter arguments to that, so I don't know if we need to spend a lot of time on addressing their belief. Not seeing a rush of hands to elaborate on the no. 74, Marika?
This is Marika, 74, again a comment from the registrar survey, which says domain should be moved into holding accounts at the registrar under the case, I guess it should be until the case is sorted.
Which creates a problem that we've already identified in 71 and 70. I think this is one of those that all we can say is noted, but we're probably not going to suggest that that's the answer, unless there are other protections at the same time which allow registrants to make some changes. Getting to be a hairy model we're coming up with. Any other comments on 74? I also think it's a business practice issue that I don't think we're going to be able to enforce. 75.
In regards to 75, we, again, comment from the Register survey, we are uncertain what safeguards are being referred to in this case. Placing a domain name on Registrar Log does not prevent the name from resolving, nor does it prevent changes to the content of the site. Therefore, no harm would be done in preventing the name from changes to the who is, and would prevent the registrant from engaging in cyber flight.
A statement which I believe we said we've proven, we've indicated is false in the case of a registrar need to change the DNS servers, at the very least.
Yeah, I think, Christine, I think this again is like that first question I responded to, which is the registrar who wrote this comment is probably doing it right and is wondering, scratching their head, wondering what the problem is. Because these people, appears in 75, are probably not, you know, not preventing changes.
I'm not quite sure I agree with you, because the last sentence says there's no harm in preventing name from changes to the who is. What's that? Hold on. No.
Right. I guess, I guess that the only thing is what would you change in the who is? Just the named servers, right? The server name, the named servers?
Yeah, that may be what, you know.
Yeah, but for UDRP purposes, we don't, like I said, we don't care what the name servers are. We only look at the contact information.
Yeah, but this answer seems to be implying that since we're not stopping the registrant from changing the content of the website, we are not restricting them in any way. And that, of course, is not the case if, you know, if your web provider goes out of business and you must change the DNS pointers. So we've already captured that, the concept. I don't think I think we're disagreeing a little bit with this answer, but it's not adding any new information to us.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're just interpreting the question differently. I agree.
76.
This is Marika, again, a comment from the Registrar survey. Privacy and personal information protection. Use services such as web and email until the decision, unless seizure or court order.
I'm not quite sure I know what this is saying. Can someone interpret? Jonathan.
Yeah, this is Jonathan again. I think what they're saying is that they just don't want the web and email services to be impacted while the case is pending. I guess the way I'm reading it is that to the extent that those services would involve privacy and personal info. I think, because I mean, if they're talking about the disclosure of the identity and all that stuff, I mean, that's a whole separate conversation. You know, that's a separate topic. But I think they're saying that their web and email services wouldn't be disrupted by a lock during while the case is pending. No, at least that's how I read it.
Yeah, I'm not sure the relevance of the lead-in privacy and personal information protection, though.
Yeah, I agree. I think if anything, it's maybe as to the extent that stuff applies to their web and email, maybe because they're people. I mean, obviously, in your email you have all sorts of stuff. that wouldn't be compromised, either disrupted or otherwise provided to the complaining party or something. It's definitely confusing. So,
yeah, I was reading it as revealing who the registrant is and who is, if it was done through a privacy proxy service, that is not taking responsibility for the overall name. And I read it as that this particular registrar was saying that it shouldn't be revealed unless seizure or court order. Marika, do we know who answered these questions, and can we go back and ask for clarification if we really wanted to?
This is Marika. Yes, I could probably go back into the survey and try to figure out only if they actually left their name and details.
Okay, that was awesome.
We did allow people not to fill it in, but if they did, I could.
Yeah, I think we've already captured the concept if they did mean that. So I don't think we need to worry about it in this case. But other than concern over revealing who the true registrant of record is, or who the true registrant is, I don't really see, and we've already captured that concept, I'm not sure I know what else they're talking about here. But I don't think it adds anything. No other thoughts? Then let's just put a comment saying we presume this is talking about revealing who the registrant is, and let's just go on. 77. Cannot answer.
Rick, number
yeah, go ahead.
77, that's from the responses that the URP providers provided. So the first one there is, cannot answer that as I'm not sure what the dangers from which registrants must be protected are.
Okay.
Just raise my hand and say that was me that wrote that, and So I was looking at it from the you know, sort of good acting, you know, provider or lock, you know, registrar way. Now that we've had these conversations, I have a little bit better idea of a couple of the problems. Like we talked about not being able to change your name servers and that sort of thing. So we don't really need to address that if we don't want to.
Okay. I don't think it doesn't add anything we need to address that. Other than what we already know, we have to talk about. 78.
This is Marika, again, comment from the UDRP provider survey. If the domain name may be locked upon the notification by the complainant to the registrar and without confirmation by a UDRP provider that the complaint has been filed properly under UDRP, the rules and supplemental rules, i.e., it's an applicable dispute and the fees have been paid accordingly, additional safeguards may need to be created to protect the registrant.
All right. I guess that says that if we were to come out with a rule saying the domain must be locked prior to instruction from the UDRP provider, that we would have to consider other safeguards. Am I summarizing, Marika or John?
This is Marika, because I actually have a question about this specific item, because this is one of the areas I'm looking at for the straw man proposal. And my question is there. I've seen indeed that the UDRP requires, or the supplemental rules require the complainant to notify the registrant. But I think at the same time, that's probably one of the main causes of having cyberflight, where, you know, the domain name is not locked yet before UDRP provider contacts the registrar. So I'm wondering, is there any other reason why the complainant has to notify the registrant at the time it files a complaint with the UDRP provider, or is that something that could be considered as being changed, as saying, okay, the notification actually to the registrant comes from the UDRP provider at the time the complaint is verified and it's sent at the same time to the registrar and the registrant? Is that something that would be feasible, or are there other reasons why you would want the complainant to notify the registrant at the same time as filing the complaint with the UDRP provider?
not have me one of the people who wrote this in a very short period of time, I'll point out, in somewhere around 1999. I don't know the rationale behind it. Jonathan?
Yeah, and I was going to say, I was actually just going to answer your other question when you were saying if that was how everyone else, you know, we read the question or the comment, and I did, you know, I was in, I think it was in line with yours, but to speak to the other piece, yeah, and I don't know the rationale behind it either, but I don't know, and we were, this was a lot of the dialogue we were having prior to Toronto, when we were talking about the concerns about CyberFlight and the notification of the registrant and just that process in general, and yeah, I agree. I don't know that what the rationale would be for the notification of the registrant by the complainant. I think, you know, my view is that, you know, when you talk about CyberFlight, I mean, there is a much better chance that if you don't give the registrars a head start on locking the name and you give the registrant, who is a potential bad guy, the heads up that the complaint is filed and is in process, it does give them a head start ahead of the registrar to get the name transferred, you know, to get out before the lock. So, you know, I think, and then again, that is a lot of what we were touching on prior to Toronto. So, you know, I'm not sure what the rationale would be for that notification. So.
Yeah, Christine?
Yeah, so if you read the way the UDRP is sort of generally written, there are several places throughout the UDRP where I think the drafters in 98 and 99 had sort of a, you know, they didn't anticipate some of the bad actions that exist today. So, they're, you know, obviously we didn't think about CyberFlight. I think a lot of times people were thinking, you know, I think people didn't realize there would be as many defaults as there are. And I think people didn't really realize that there could be bad actor registrars or bad actor registrants who would be, you know, trying to avoid the process. I think they were thinking, well, this would be a great dispute resolution process for people who, you know, might want to respond or that sort of thing. So there's more than one place in the UDRP, but this service of respondents, you know, before the case is commenced, is one of them, where it seems like there was sort of this basis of trust and like, well, you know, no one's really going to game the system. But now we've learned over years that they are. So I think that, and if we've seen that the URS changed that, right? So they're not serving respondents until the lock. So it unfortunately is there in the UDRP, and, you know, unless the UDRP itself is amended, this is something that we, you know, can't, you can't really change at this point. And I think, you know, forum's not really in favor of amending the UDRP generally, but this is the first thing on our list if we do.
You know, I would tend to differ that if this is something that we've come up with that essentially makes locking moot because the respondent is notified ahead of time, then I think this is within our scope, or certainly something we can claim with is within our scope. So I would not shy away from that. My personal position, I'm not speaking on behalf of counsel, obviously, or on behalf of McKaylee.
Okay, but, yeah, and if you're correct, then, you know, hallelujah.
Yeah. I really can't see us saying we're allowed to change the time at which it's locked, but it's still going to be irrelevant anyway because it allows CyberFlight. The whole purpose of locking is to stop bad things from happening. And so I think we have to look at the overall environment around locking, not just locking. And I think you're right. I think this whole thing was written on the presumption that this is indeed a dispute resolution mechanism where two parties will come and argue why they think each of them is right, whereas that's not what's happening in a fair number of the cases right now. Christina, are you want back in, or... Is your hand up from before? I think it's from before.
Yeah, my apologies. It's from before.
That's okay. I've left mine up too by mistake. I'm not quite sure where we are at this point. Marika, your suggestion, I think, doesn't fix it because if the registrar is notified at the same time as the complainant by the UDRP provider, you still have a... It's a smaller window, but you still have a window, in which case, you know, Flight is possible. The presumption is that if we want to lock, if we want to close that window altogether, that the complainant shouldn't be notified till after the lock is in place. That may cause another set of problems, but
just to clarify, Alan, you mean the respondent should be notified, correct?
Did I not say that?
They complain it.
Oh well.
Okay. just for the transcript.
No difference, right?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Let's try to do one more, and then we'll look at how we're going to proceed in the future. Marika?
Yes, this is Marika. So comment 79, also from the UDRP providers survey. It would be good to have an example so as to better understand what kind of safeguards the drafter of the questionnaire had in mind. We suppose that the question is if the registrants could possibly face under ungrounded locking. Example given in instances of reverse domain name hijacking, and if there is a way how to prevent such situations. Unfortunately, it's highly difficult as the question of whether the locking is grounded or not is resolved only in the UDRP decision. If anyone, the registrar, the provider, or the panel, would be required to address it earlier, it would be necessary to estimate the result of the dispute in advance, which is not only impossible but inappropriate as well.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, the URS has provision for multiple abusive URS proceedings, but I think that clearly is out of our scope to suggest that we do something similar here. That very much is not locking, but treating, but you know, a much more core part of the UDRP. So I'm not sure what else we can do on in terms of that. I think the only issue is the revealing of privacy proxy information. Other than that, we have no way of determining ahead of time that it is reverse hijacking. That, again, that's very out of our scope, I think. No hands up? Then let's look. What more do we have? We have... From 80
Marika,
to,
if we do one more, at least we finish this section.
Okay, then you sold me. Go ahead.
So the last comment in on this specific charter question is from the FICPI. This question should be further studied on possible way to balance the need for accurate who is registrant information and privacy rights. Would be to make the identity of the underlying registrant details known only to the registrar, parties of the UDRP proceeding, as well as the panelists, in such cases where a need to keep information private has been demonstrated.
I think that captures some of what we've been talking about in a more concise way than what we've been saying before. So I think that's to be considered. Christine.
Yeah, this is Christine. I would say the this specific issue, it seems to be addressed more toward what happens to that information once the privacy service is lifted. It doesn't really go toward the lock itself. I think it's dealing more with a public policy issue as far as, you know, keeping accurate who is information and balancing privacy rights. Currently, at least for forum cases, a panel is presented. If the privacy shield is not lifted in the who is, but the registrant information is provided to us, we send that information to the panel, and then we allow the panel to make a determination as to whether or not the privacy service should be the respondent or whether they should, you know, name the actual respondent in the complaint and sort of out them, if you will. And so that's done on a case-by-case basis in front of each individual panelist who has the opportunity to hear from both parties as to why or why not that information should be lifted. And I don't think, in my opinion, that this is really relevant to our lock group. However, it's more relevant generally to the discussion of who is and who is privacy and ways to sort of balance people's privacy rights with that, you know, with the need to figure out who owns the domain name. So in my opinion, it's not really related to the changing of the who is or the locking of the who is at that moment. It's down, farther downstream.
It's Alan speaking. I tend to agree, except depending on how we define lock, it may or may not become relevant to us. If we define lock saying that you must not change any of the information in WHOIS, including the names of the registrant. And clearly you have to reveal them to the UDRP provider, but you must not change it in WHOIS. We're implicitly addressing this issue, at least part of it.
Oh, I see. So we could actually go and make a recommendation that the privacy service has to reveal to the provider. Because I guess I'm assuming currently
And that it cannot change the WHOIS, though.
Yeah, right. Okay, so that is definitely one way of approaching it. Okay.
Yeah, we may fix the problem even though it wasn't a problem in our domain, depending on how we define lock.
Right.
And go ahead. So
that's interesting for Marika then to note on her straw man.
Whether we want to do that or not is a different issue.
Right.
It's sort of a back alley way of changing something which is probably out of our scope by intent, but it may end up being something that we have control over.
Right. And I've thrown this out there a few times, and I think it may be just maybe a subtle disagreement or difference or different understanding of our mission, but I think there's also a possibility to have best practices come out of it as well. Even things that maybe aren't mandates and within the true scope of what we're here to do, we could make a list of suggested best practices, in my opinion.
That's an outcome of any PDP. Of course, no way to enforce, but we can say the words and perhaps people will listen. Okay, Marika, we have finished your section. We have a total of 81 through 83 at the end that we haven't done yet. And how many, where do we start at the beginning?
One to 39 we haven't done. So basically the first three charter questions we haven't address specifically the comments there.
Do we have any volunteers who are willing to take one of the charter? Are they sort of equally divided among the three charter questions, or is there a predominant number?
The first one has 17 comments in it. The next one is from 18 to 25, and the third one is from 26 to 39.
So they're not equal, but they're not completely unbalanced. Do we have anyone who's willing to do a pass of them and draft things for our consideration?
This is Christine. Just to clarify, are you asking to fill in a suggested response to each comment in the box as we have been doing, or summarize all of the questions and do something else with that?
I believe what I'm suggesting, and I think what Marika was suggesting, was draft for each question what the working group believes the right answer is, or what you believe the working group should give as the answer.
And this is Marika, and in some comments it might be as easy as noted or needs to be further discussed. I think you see as well, it depends a bit on the level of detail in the comment, the kind of responses we provided. So.
Yeah. Right, so for each question, 15, 16, so, those... You want something filled in for each one, right?
That's what we're looking for.
Okay. What's the deadline we're looking at?
If we don't have a meeting next week and we cancel the following one, we're talking prior to the meeting 3 weeks from now.
Okay. Well, I could volunteer for the section. And I don't really care which one.
All right. We'll take you up on that. And how about section one?
Sure. That's fine.
Or charter question one, rather. Anyone else willing to do two or three? Who is the smaller one? Three is slightly longer. Christine has taken the longest one already. No volunteers here. Let's do it out on the list, Marika, if we can look for volunteers to do that.
Okay.
This is Lori. I'll do two.
Oh, thank you. Have we embarrassed anyone into taking three?
This is Jonathan. I'll take three.
Thank you, sir. Thank you all. Okay. Marika, do you want to just send out a quick note asking how many people will not be able to attend the Thanksgiving meeting?
Yeah, it is, Marika. I'll do, and I think I already noted in the... in the chat. You know, from our perspective, I think it would be really good if we could still have a meeting next week, even if it would just be to review some of the responses that were received. And I think Barry or myself would be happy to lead the call if no one else is willing. And, you know, unless, of course, we have really a few members on the call only.
Yeah, I might even be able to participate. I'm just not in a position to take a lead on it because I'm going to be doing other things in parallel. So I can probably listen in if you or Barry can lead it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if it's just a question going through the comments, and I think, you know, either of us would be perfectly happy to do so.
Okay, then everyone's agreed. Then we will have a meeting next week. We will not cancel. And that pushes Marika, that presumes that the people who are going to be drafting answers will be doing it for next week, which was not what we just said when we asked for volunteers.
Well, hopefully some of you will be able to do so.
Okay.
At least we have something to look at.
All right, Marika, I'll leave it to you to decide to cancel on short notice if indeed nothing has been turned in terms of draft answers. And other than that, I will possibly see you on a meeting next week or in 2 weeks. That sound okay to everyone?
Yep, perfect.
Okay. Thank you all for being here today. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Marika.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.